Wild courage exists to galvanize a generation of men. The tools and courage to fight for what matters most. And tell the stories that are born in the redemption of lives and souls.
Hey guys, before we jump into Tyler's story, I just wanted to let you guys know that we're having a Wild Courage retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming on April 28th through the 30th. That's a check-in around 5 o'clock on the Friday, the April 28th, and it'll conclude around Sunday at noon on the 30th. And if any of you guys are interested, we are reserving a few spots for our podcast listeners to this inclusive retreat. It's small, intimate setting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the beautiful Diamond Cross Ranch. And I just wanted to throw the invite out there. If anybody's interested in more information or attending, you can shoot us an email at info@thewildcourage.life. That's info@thewildcourage.life. I'll also throw a link on the show notes of the podcast. So let us know. It's coming up pretty quick and we only have a few spots left. So yeah, hopefully if you're interested, let us know. Thanks. Hey guys, welcome back or to the Wild Courage Podcast. Today we're in Emmett, Idaho in the barn, live, coming at you hot with my buddy Jay Heck, who's in town, and my new buddy, Tyler Avent. Did I get it right?
Yes, sir.
Sweet. And we had an incredible weekend this weekend, and instead of doing this over Zoom, I thought, let's get these guys in here, and we have some time this morning. So we're going to do some story. And it's the first time I've ever got to have two other guys on. So this is new and exciting for me. So first off, thank you guys for saying yes to this. Jay?
Yeah, super fun to
welcome.
Be here.
It's been a long time of coming to get you here.
It has. Yes, it's been a great weekend. So this is fun.
Yep. And my new buddy, Tyler, we met in Elko at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, 3 weeks ago, I think.
Yep. Justin Reichert hooked us up, and we got to be, which was super cool, we got to be on a panel together discussing emotional and mental health and addiction and suicide in the cowboy community, which Tyler.
Super cool. Super scary for me, because that was the first time. I mean, I've told my story a lot to friends and family and things, but standing in front of 80 plus people and just getting real, that was really scary, but it was super rewarding at the same time.
Yeah, I was super proud of Justin and Cole for doing that, because there's not been an awareness about this, and we're losing too many friends to suicide in our cowboy community.
Well, and the thing about it now is the cat's out of the bag, so yep. to say. Like, it was taboo for us to talk about those things for years, feelings, addiction, whatever. And the cat's out of the bag now, man. So
you can't put that toothpaste back in.
No, we just get to get it on now.
Yep. So that was super fun for us to get to kind of meet that way. And then just real quick, our Wild Courage fires we've been doing in the barn for 3 years now. We just had a lot of guys reach out and like want to be a part of that and figure out how to do it. So we thought, well, let's invite a bunch of dudes from all over the place, all over the country came this weekend, and we just did Wild Courage around the fire. Really, it was an equipping of kind of some of the things we've learned, but really just to get to know each other, and for these guys who want to go home and start fires to know they're not alone and that they got a brotherhood that they're plugged into now. And so it was really surreal for Brian and Doc and I to have Jay Heck come from San Antonio, Texas, who's really the godfather in, around this fire community thing we built and has championed us, because Jay's had a fire in Texas and also his fires spread out all over the country as well. over 8.5 years ago. So to have you here, Jay, and to plug into us, it just really goes to the humility you have and the heart you have for this message and this brotherhood. So thanks so much for jumping up here and joining us.
Sure. I don't know how much humility it was. I just was excited to see what God's doing with something that started basically in my backyard 8 years ago. I never would have thought. So it's just been a joy.
Yeah, it's been super fun. And so Tyler has a beautiful redemption story, which is what this whole thing is about. And so we're just going to jump into your story and kind of go back to where it all started and give a little background of how you grew up and where you grew up and what you've given your life to and what the journeys look like for that to been. And Jay and I are just going to jump in where we feel like there's a sweet spot in your story and kind of maybe ask some more questions right around that area and just kind of go through to where you've landed today and the beautiful redemption that is your story and who you are and becoming. So all I know is that we know a lot of the same people and that you're a badass cowboy turned horse trainer. And where did that all begin for you? Are you first generation, second generation? Like where did it come from?
The Avent side of my family have always been, as far back as I know lineage wise, have been cowboys.
Always in the Southwest?
Yes, sir. Panhandle of Texas, Oklahoma. I don't know a lot of the genealogy about where we came from, nothing like that. Kind of a little bit of gypsies in there. You know, I think the family wasn't afraid to roam. But for me, I was born in Elkhart, Kansas. And my dad, we lived around Boy City, Oklahoma. When I was real young, he run a background yearling deal. And so that's kind of been my life, is cows and horses. I mean, he's been a cowboy my entire life. And the home I grew up in the longest was in Kenton, north of Kenton, Oklahoma, where the three states marker is, Oklahoma, Colorado, and New Mexico connect. I grew up in a home 2 miles north of that.
Oh, dang. I didn't know that. I thought you were born and reared in New Mexico. Okay.
No, sir. I'm one of the chosen few, you can say, that has peed in three states at one time.
That's pretty cool. I don't know anybody else ever that can say that.
Yeah. So, you know, that was we lived at the mouth of Furnish Canyon. That canyon run for 14 miles, and the people we worked for owned the bottom of the canyon and then the tops on both sides, and we leased a bunch of ground. And that place, if I remember right, it would run like 500 mother cows. And then Dad would take in some yearlings in the summer.
So you grew up horseback doing all the things.
All
next,
the things.
Next to Dad.
Grew up around a lot of good cowboys. We would go in the spring. We'd go to the Perkins and Pro Throw Ranch. They're on the Oklahoma-Texas line by Stratford, Texas. And we'd stay there and brand calves all summer, and it was usually 2 or 3 weeks and run through. I think that place had run anywhere from 1,500 to 2,500 mother cows.
Nice.
And
so you really got to not only grow up with your dad and seeing that, but that's the cool thing about the drifting and getting to go experience and see how other people do it is I think you get to learn a lot more, right? Because you're like, gosh dang, that guy rides a pretty nice horse. What is he doing? And
oh man, I was so fortunate because I got to grow up around my heroes. I got to grow up around cowboys.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty cool. That's how I felt too. When I grew up during junior high, we were at the ZX in Paisley, Oregon, which Paisley's like 100 people. You either work for the Forest Service or this ranch, the ZX ranch. And we only went to school 4 days a week. So on Fridays, I got to trot out with the cowboy crew. You know, they'd run the horses in on the ropes and rope them out, and they'd always have some old thing half broke that I could ride. And man, trotting out with those guys, like you said, with your heroes, that was life, man. Fridays and Saturdays, I got to be a cowboy when I was in seventh and eighth grade, and it's pretty cool.
Well, I was that feral child that when spring hit and dad would tell me Brandon's were going to start happening, I would turn into the little heathen at school and get into a lot of trouble. And dad finally said, well, you just, maybe we'll take these 2-3 weeks and you can just go with me. And then I don't have to go to the principal's office so much.
Oh yeah. You got it figured out.
And one cool thing we did was, so there were some ranches that my dad and all of his buddies, they come together and we'd pull a wagon out and we'd start at the Vincent Ranch and then, drive them horses and take them wagon or start usually at the Vincent place and then go through Jim Ferguson's place and then end up at our place. And I don't remember how many miles it was we went, but we were out on that wagon for a good while.
And just Brandon.
Just Brandon Kevs and
yeah.
And doing all the things. And I mean, it was a great way to grow up.
The best, right? When you're in that, it's like, who's got a better me? Especially when, and we were talking earlier about Bear, like trying to figure out what you want to do when you go to college and grow up and like what way. And for me and you, I think I knew my whole, like there was never any, like, I wonder what I'm going to, like, it was always this, right?
You know, like, and there was like
going to be a cowboy.
There was, you know, growing up, you aspire to do other things, but, I always come back to it. You know, I thought for a while I wanted to be an ag teacher because my uncle was an ag teacher. And I was big into the showing. Like I showed my first hog when I was 3 years old and he kind of quit the hog deal and we raised some show goats. And then I always had a pile of calves. We started raising show calves and that old farren barn, I turned it into a cool room and we'd always have calves in there on feed. And I loved that. And would cowboy in between there and stuff. And I always had a colt or two around there in high school. I lived with my grandparents a lot because it was 55 miles from town to that ranch.
Oh, dang.
And every once in a while, I'd get to drive a pickup to a neighbor girl's house and then get on the bus and riding a cheese wagon for that long was horrible. So I would stay with my grandparents a lot. And
they lived in town or closer to town?
Yeah, they lived just north of Boise City a little ways. And my mom was a nurse there in town. So
wait, if your mom was a nurse in town, did she make that drive every day or did she stay at the grandparents?
She would stay sometimes at the grandparents, but a lot, you know, she'd go back and forth. We'd both go back and forth a lot.
So how was home life? I mean, it's all relative when you're growing up, but looking back now, like.
Well, there's good and bad in anything, you know?
Sure.
They both loved me and I never needed or wanted for nothing. I mean, I always had all the things.
Yeah.
My mom was a very, very loving person and my dad was too, in his own way, I guess. But he was the worker and the provider for the family. Like he was there, but he wasn't there, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think to be fair to that generation too, of our dads, like their parents grew up in the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like how we get the opportunity to raise our sons now, because we all have sons. It wasn't like that for our dad. So to me, it's like looking back at this whole thing with a ton of grace, like you're doing for them. And like, cause it doesn't take us very far to look back at how they were raised to see how much better of a job they did than maybe their dads did who grew up in the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. Or like talking about your emotions was bitching and moaning. And when you grew up in the Great Depression, it was like, if you got fed, you had nothing to complain about. And that hasn't translated well down through those generations, right? So to your point, it's like, man, our dads did the best they knew how to do, and they did a pretty good job knowing what we know now and what we're doing different with our sons. It's like, it's nice to look at it objectively and be like, yeah, my dad blew it in a lot of areas, but man, he sure did a much better job than his dad did. And that's kind of the cool part of the grace and all of this of going back and objectively looking at how we grew up and were raised and identifying, right? and then fixing some things up and loving our dads and our moms and having grace for them. And
I think my dad did do the best that he could. I'm never going to cuss him for the way he raised me, because it grew me up to be the man I am today.
Absolutely.
There's good and bad that come with it, but we've never talked about it yet. I hope we get to those conversations one day. I hope me and my dad get to that spot, but he grew up really rough.
Yep.
His dad was really hard on him.
Yep. That's really my point, hard, right? They generally do a better job without any tools. It's a miracle, really. And
another thing on my mom and dad's behalf is my mom was 17 and I was 18 when they got pregnant with me. They were super young.
Oh, your dad was 18?
Yeah, and my mom was 17.
Yeah, me too.
And they were still trying to figure out life themselves, much less bring a newborn child into this deal.
Can you imagine being 18 and having a kid? I couldn't literally balance a checkbook. I couldn't manage like my own laundry, let alone throw a kid into it. Yeah, tons of grace.
You know, and looking back on it, like after this weekend, there's been a flood of things come over me. I guess a new perspective, way of looking at things. But it was a great childhood. Was there some things that could have been done different? Yeah. But we can't change that now. It's maybe led me to some of my faults and things, but we're going to get over that now.
That's right.
We're on the path.
Did you hang around after high school?
No. I thought I wanted to go to college, thought I wanted to do that thing. So I moved 8 hours away to Northeastern Oklahoma and tried to go to college in NEO. They kicked me out of that one and didn't attend a lot of class. I rodeoed and was wild and we partied and did all the things.
Did that start in high school at all?
Oh, yeah. Small town. You know, Boise City is a very small town. I graduated with 14 kids.
Oh, yeah.
And you drug Maine and you drank beer. And out there with my grandparents, you know, me and my buddy Pinky is what I called him. We would find us a trucker or the old town drunk, and he'd buy us a box of beer, and we'd sit out there in that cool room all night and just work with Kev's hair and jam out and just get blistered.
And parents had no idea.
They're not as dumb as what I thought they were at the time. Yeah, they knew. I mean, when you get drunk and you walk in the house in the middle of the night and pass out and wake up in the morning and look like a wrecked mess for breakfast. My grandparents knew. And you know, there were some other things in college. Like I skipped school with a girl one time and went to her house and we got on a handle of Crown. And I remember ending up in town at her dad's feed store. The last thing I remember was raising up, asking where that bottle was, and I passed out. And my mom, a lot of people were like, the kids were scared of her, like Mama Avent was real. I didn't wake up, but my buddy Pinky found me in a pile of tires at the tire shop in town, and I was puking up blood and like alcohol poisoning to the max, I guess.
And this is like would have been your freshman year, like you're 18, 19 years old.
Yeah. You know, junior, sophomore, somewhere in there. And the next thing I remember was waking up the next morning at my grandparents' house, and my mom was standing there and she said, "Get the fuck up. You're going to school." Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is in high school.
Yeah, this is in high school.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, fast forward to college, like the drinking and the fun. And I mean, that's so growing up on those ranches, you know, you, me and my wife were talking about this morning, but you don't grow up around a lot of kids. You're out there. You go to town. To school. So school for me was a social thing. I got that social interaction, or going to rodeos
or stuff like that. And then you were back on the ranch. And
back
so,
to isolation.
So I, yeah. And like me and my buddy Pinky, we self-isolated a lot out there in that barn and drank and did the things.
So that kind of carried right on to college, even though you were more socially active because now you're around more people.
Yeah. We're living in the dorms. I'm making buddies. We're doing the things. It's, you know, it's a fun time in your life, I guess. And so they kicked me out of that school and worked around there. My parents had moved out there to Pryor, Oklahoma, and my dad started training horses. He left the ranching and wanted to pursue a career as a horse trainer and worked for a guy out there. And that was kind of his start. And so I worked for them for a summer, and then I took care of some yearlings with some other people and that summer, and then went to Lamar, Colorado to LCC and lasted maybe a semester and a half. And I'm like, man, this is not my gig. I just can't be in the classroom, want to be outside. They had an equine program, started some colts through that and left there. Left there, went to Gainesville Tech. But left Lamar and went to Gainesville, Texas, and went to work for Tommy Mannion, riding two-year-olds, cutters, and met a girl there that I thought I loved, and that turned out to be lust and just a bad deal. You know, it just seemed like the drinking and the partying and well, I guess before I worked at Tommy's, I worked at Harris Equine and did some repro stuff. Kurt was a friend of the family and did some mare reproduction stuff, bred some mares, did some things, partied a lot, woke up on somebody's porch one morning, was late for work, had to beg and plead for my job back. Like Kurt was done, and life was just one big party for a long time. I didn't care about the repercussions of things.
So starting to show up in your life more than just the fun.
Oh yeah.
The fun college guy. Cause when you take that into the real world, the consequences do start showing up.
Definitely. Definitely.
But the interesting thing about the cowboy world is moving around a lot is so part of the gig. Like if you think about the subculture of the horse training world, cowboy world, because they're real similar, is nobody stays anywhere very long. So it sets up this like perfect storm for guys like us to be on the go. And it's not a resume hit if you've worked for 10 guys in 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, cool, you've learned a lot. Where anywhere else, you're not going to get hired. If you've had six jobs in 2 years, it's a red flag. And in our culture, it's like, sweet, you're going to bring all that knowledge here. And it's kind of like everybody knows that nobody sticks around long. And it's a lot to do with this whole being on the run thing. Like we were, you know, of like, it catches up. It's time to leave.
And looking back on it all now, like I was just so lost. The guidance was never there. You know, you grow up and what at the time, I guess I felt like was a pretty structured household. Like my mom was pretty strict and so was dad. But I got left with my grandparents and I just went and did things.
Knowing what you know now, looking back, do you feel like you were abandoned?
That's hard to say. Maybe yes and no. You know, I think mom and dad worked a lot and they were providing and doing the things that they knew how to do. And they had a child and that maybe they really didn't know how to raise him, but they did the best they could. So I guess in a sense, yeah. maybe there was some abandonment there, like grow up.
Yeah, I say that just because I spent a lot of years growing up with grandma and grandpa too. My mom and dad were trying to figure it out, and in their own brokenness of divorce and marriage and divorce and marriage and that cycle. So I grew up spending most of my on and off childhood with grandma and grandpa, which was a safe haven for me at some point. But yeah, it's like something's wrong. Aren't I supposed to be with mom and dad? Like, it's a thing.
And my grandmother, Bonnie, is my rock. She always has been. Like, that woman would bail me out of anything. I mean, I was in high school. I stole her. I pushed her car out of their driveway onto the road, turned the lights on to where it wouldn't shine on the house, and I drove to town. I jacked a bottle of little pint of Crown out of granddad's deal, and they come to town in the middle of the night and find me, and I'm blistered. And we go back home, and yeah, I felt bad about doing it at the time, and there was some slight repercussions, but then it was like it was gone.
Yeah.
On to the next one. But to get back to kind of where we are in the deal, do Pilot Point and the horse training deal for a while, and went back to northeastern Oklahoma. Well, right before that, I went to Midland, Texas, and went to work for some people with that girl, and that ended bad. So my parents come move me back to take me back to northeastern Oklahoma, and I'm living on a buddy's couch helping him take care of yearlings. And
do you think that was your first real heartbreak?
Yes. Yes, I do.
How'd you handle that?
Drank it away. Found another girl. Did the things, you know. Yeah. That was living. And moved back there, and Brian, my buddy, helped me get back on my feet, him and his wife, and found a place to lease and got a bunch of colts to ride and was leasing a little indoor cut and pen and thought I was going to be a horse trainer on my own and take care of yearlings. And, you know, through the drinking and the partying and all the things, like, I didn't do it. I failed short. Brian had called my dad and he said, "Hey, I think Tyler's in a pretty bad spot." And then dad called and said, "Hey, I just let a girl go at T-Cross." He said, "You gonna come ride colts for me?" And I was like, "You bet, man. I'll be there in the morning."
Yeah, no, not the pressure kind of goes away if you just got to show up and do the thing, right? No dealing with any clients really and billing and all the fun things that come along with hanging your shingle out as a colt guy.
So I get the few horses I have at that time dispersed, and I think it was 3 days, and I've got all my stuff in Colorado, and started colts at T-Cross for 3 years.
Was that the longest you'd ever been anywhere to that point?
Yeah, other than in my adulthood, yes.
Yeah.
2.5, 3 years. I think's what it was. And that's when I met some people and things started, some drugs started. You know, I'd smoke a little pot in college and maybe snort some pills and things like that. And got to run around with some people on the ranch and a few of them smoked weed. And you know, you live in Colorado, so that's like, okay, everybody's hippies.
Yeah, that was even before it was legal. It was legal.
Yeah. And you know, and everybody, you know, you get that bad rap, cowboys and hippies don't jive. Mm-hmm. Like, that's BS. I would go up into Colorado Springs to a little town, and I'd kick it on the river with the hippies, and we'd get stoned and drink beer and have a great time. And like, bought me a little magic flight, that's what it was called. It was a vape, or you know, stick a battery in it, it heats the weed up, and then there's no smoke, right? Well, I would carry, it looked like a pack of gum, and I would carry that thing around all day and just ride colts and smoke weed like I was so happy. And those are some of the best Colts I've probably ever started.
Yeah, because you were chilled out.
Yeah, just mellow, like no stress. Like, we're just going to go ride around and do the things.
Yeah, Les Vogt said his horse never stopped better when he smoked, because he had run down and stop and then light a cigarette and sit there. And when he quit smoking, his horses stopped starting as good, because he had not let him soak long enough before he'd go running back down to the other end, which is kind of the same thing. Yeah. Like,
but the Norris family gave me a great opportunity. Like, I got to show some and get a taste of that. And we would start anywhere from 24 to 30 colts a year.
Oh, nice.
And keep those horses for 3 years. And then the ranch would put on a sale. So it was a lot of work, but it was fun. And we'd get to go cowboy at their cow ranch and stuff too. But, you know, I remember living in that house alone up there, and, you know, and just mom and dad and the rules. Like, I really wouldn't go over there much. I'd see dad at work and all the things, but I just was a problem drinker and a problem pot smoker. Like, I loved not feeling. I mean, I'd get so high on my porch, I'd throw a skirt steak on the grill and just sit out there and smoke a joint or two and just get numb and couldn't get up drinking and stuff. So that leads into more of life, but the numbing and, you know, later on we'll talk about the drugs getting worse, but had another, you know, a few relationships in there, kind of thought I wanted to marry some of them girls. I didn't love them. I loved what was between their legs. That's the fact of the matter there. And got out of that last bad relationship. And this is kind of the story of how I met my wife. We got out of that relationship and just give you the short version of it. But my uncle was her ag teacher in Clayton, New Mexico. And I'd go over there all the time and clip calves and hang out with my uncle. And I never knew the girl, which was way better off, or we'd never be married. So she gets out of a bad relationship. And my uncle had married a friend of hers that was older, that worked at the bank, my aunt, a great woman. And they're like, hey, she told Steph, she said, I think you need to meet my nephew. So we talk on the phone for a week or two, and somehow I conjure into driving from Clayton, New Mexico to Pueblo, Colorado to go on a date. And like, I'll get you a motel room, we'll do all the things, it'll be fun. So we go on the date, and it just got good from there. Like, I knew pretty instantly that was the girl I was going to marry. We date for 2.5 years. I'm sure her story will be different than mine, but we date for like 2.5 years. And I go to her house one weekend in Clayton, and I've got the ring and all the things. And my wife's a very busy person, always doing stuff. And I walk outside and try to do it, and she like gets all busy, and I don't know if she knew it was coming. She's never told me, but you know, I think you could sense that tension, the thing. So finally she's just scurrying around being busy doing all the things, and I said, hey, do you want this? And she looked, and I was holding that ring, and you know, and then of course she said yes, and
you're so romantic.
But yeah, it. You know, just Rico Suave here. But in the midst of all that, I had a good buddy call me in New Mexico and said, hey, I'm running a yearling deal. I'd love for you to come to work for me. I need someone I can trust and depend on. And me and Garrett had grown up all our lives together. Super good dude. Still a good friend of mine. And so we run that yearling deal and that rocked along for, I don't know, I think a year, a little over. And I got crippled, and it kind of made the boss mad. So I told him where he could stick that job. Steph had moved in with me. Her family used to own the First National Banks in New Mexico. They had a branch in Santa Rosa, and she was working out of there. And you know, we hadn't lived together a super long time at that point. And called her at work and said, hey, we got 2 weeks to find somewhere else to be. And she's like, well, what? That's our home. Like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. We'll figure it out. It'll be fine.
She's not used to this cowboy lifestyle yet.
She grew up on a ranch there in New Mexico for a while. Family lost it. Whole different story. But, yeah, you know, there was a lot of security with her deal there. And moving was just something you did. Like, I never felt like those, looking back, like now, you know, when I got older, like them ranches weren't homes. That was just the house I lived in at the time.
Yep.
By the time I hit the highway, usually I knew where I was, which direction to go, right or left. And so I go to calling around and calling some friends and get in contact with a guy pretty close there. And he's like, yeah, the Bob Gearhart Spring Valley Ranch. He needs a guy. And I drove by that place, and it's funny because I told Steph, I said, I bet that is a cool camp. I'd love to go there. And sure enough, that's where we end up. I call Bob, and how old are you? And I said, well, I think I was 22, 23, somewhere in there at the time. You're not old enough, can't use you. So I call my buddy Danny back, and I'm like, hey, man, this old guy's telling me I'm not old enough. Like, I'm more than capable. And Danny's like, I know, I'll call him. So he calls him and he's like, this is what you do. You call Bob every day until he breaks. You're the guy for that job. So I call Bob every day for a week. And finally, at the end of that week, he said, you know what, kid? I like your persistence. He said, you be in Ruidoso, New Mexico in the morning at my house. So I call Stephanie at work and I'm like, hey, you're going to have to take a day off tomorrow. We're going to interview for a job. We go to Ruidoso, meet with Bob and Dolores. 15 minutes, he throws me the keys and says, go get it on.
So you're taking your new bride to a camp job. And how far away from town is that?
We were 30 miles from Santa Rosa, or 32 miles from Santa Rosa, 30 miles from Las Vegas. And so at this time, we weren't married.
Oh, you hadn't gotten married yet?
No, we're engaged, all the things. So we get moved into that place. I have no map, no cow counts. Them people, like the last guy, kind of left him in shambles. So what do? I go to meeting the locals. There's a bar 3 miles down the road in Anton Chico or Delia. Go to the bar, buy a box of beer, meet the guy that owns the bar. He's a super cool guy with one arm. Awesome pool player, like Mexican fella. Great dude.
Pool player with one arm.
I'm telling you, like trophies in there. This guy could spank you.
Wow.
Like, get it on. So go buy a box of beer, go to driving around, just take a dirt road, find a camp house. Hey, man, where's your deal start and mine stop? And met Beanie Montano, Danny's dad. And Beanie kind of took care of that place a little, or he run that place at one time. And so me and old Beanie get in the pickup together, and he kind of showed me that outfit and just went to ranching and was there a little while. And then my parents moved north of Las Vegas, and dad was training horses for a guy there. And that's where we got married. We got married at the Black Willow Ranch in that old barn, kind of like this barn we're sitting in.
Nice. How did your wife adapt to going from being plugged into kind of her community? Her family owned the bank. She had a good job, security, probably some benefits and all the things. And then all of a sudden she's 30 miles from town in a cow camp.
Well, she still worked at the bank. She drove 30 miles a day every day.
Oh, she did. Town. Okay.
Yeah. She worked in Santa Rosa.
So she still had some ties back to some security.
Yeah.
And so, doing her own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to make it on cowboy wages for one person, much less two, you know.
Especially if you got to buy lots of them boxes of beer.
Well, definitely. I mean, 3 miles from a bar, like, but that's where we started our life together. And I run that place for almost 9 years. And
how was your marriage before you got married? How was your drinking? How was that lifestyle? Was it under control, or did she get to see glimpses of?
Oh no, like drinking and raising hell. And I mean, the first trip we ever took together was to Steamboat Springs to a bronc riding. And I go get on the bucking horse and everything's good. And then pickup man's on a green horse. I go to grab him and I'm just out there in air.
Superman style.
And bronc steps on my back and we had big plans to go dancing. Well, that didn't happen. A bottle of hydrocodone and a box of beer and a hot tub and me being crippled. That was our first big outing. And, you know, and I used to kind of have a temper. I used to kind of like to fight. That was something in college that you hit me in the face, you're not going to whip me from there down. You might stand a chance. I like to fight. But that's what cowboys did. You know, you're
yeah, heck yeah.
tough and all the things. So she got to see all of it.
So she knew it. She knew what she was marrying.
Oh yeah.
That was my question, I guess.
Yeah. And I was of the mindset of this is what you get. I mean, it took me 2.5 years. So there hasn't been a divorce in the Avent family in, I think, like 80, 90 years of the Avent history in the Bible. And we've got a big Avent family Bible that my granddad has. And so that was taboo. You didn't get divorced. Like, you figured it out. So I was like, well, I want to know, like, if you can put up with my crazy. So it took, you know, them 2.5 years. And I felt like she could probably put up with my crazy. Cause I mean,
you showed it to her.
I showed it to her, all of it. And, you know, I mean, she knew I smoked pot and drank and did all the things. If there was some cocaine around, I might take a little bump. I tried to keep that from her. She was okay with the pot and the drinking, but I think them harder drugs, it might have went a different route. So then there starts the secrets. And that ranch was a beautiful place. South boundary was the Pecos River. My little slice of heaven and hers too. Like that was her home. That was where we started our life and our family, the whole deal. And, you know, got that place fixed up, got it to going, and it was fun. And all my buddies had come over in spring and in the fall. We were kind of the place for wayward cowboys. Like, you know, I was always kind of like to drift. And so somebody'd be coming through, a buddy's buddy or whatever, and didn't have no work or no place to stay. And they'd be like, come on, man, live in the house. You just move in.
I did the exact same thing. My wife and I, the first 6 years we were married, I think we had people living with us, my old cowboy buddies.
Yeah. I mean, staying out in the saddle house all night and just drinking and
telling each other how cool we are.
Oh, yeah. You know, get those drunk stories and try to think you know about God and you think you're getting deep and you're just a freaking idiot. So
getting married didn't change anything?
No, it didn't change nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, I would go once I kind of got to knowing a bunch of people in that area, I'd go to different ranches and day work and just leave Steph there or leave that place vacant. You know, she quit working when it was a while before we got pregnant. I don't remember how long, but, she stayed at home and started, her little clothing business. She's got an online clothing business called the Thrifty Cowhand. Sorry, I had to throw that plug in here.
That's all right. We'll plug the crap out of it at the end too.
And she wanted to pursue that. You know, she was done with working in the bank and wanted to do something that made her happy. So that's what we said, well, let's get it on. And stayed at home all the time. So then that created more problems because when she was at work,
you could,
I could screw off and do whatever I wanted. Like if I wanted to go in the house and take a nap all day or
sleep that hangover off.
Yeah, whatever. It didn't matter. I could get out, you know, get out in the morning, scurry around, feed the horses, maybe go feed some cows. I knew what time she left. I could go back to the house and just get over my mess. And when she got home, I was out riding a colt or doing something busy. And then she was home all the time. And that created a real rift between us because I was still doing the same things I was doing when she was working every day.
She just knew about it now.
Yeah, she was just home all the time. And then I couldn't sit in the house and nurse my hangover. So I'd go to a buddy's camp or I'd be at the barn all the time drinking. So this leads into where my real addiction starts. But I had a buddy move in. So I had a buddy. I really didn't know him super well at the time. I'd worked around him a couple of springs at a ranch north of me, and super great guy. Loved him. And I still do. I wish the best for him. I really do. Wild, funny guy. Way too 60. Used to be a bullfighter. Like we called him Tiny Dancer. This guy was Twinkle Toes. Just fun loving, super good guy. Well, he lost his family, due to methamphetamines, and CPS wouldn't let him see his kids. And he come to me and he said, man, I've lost everything. You know, you told me that you'd help me learn your get riding horses, starting colts. And I was like, well, let's, and you know, he told me he was on drugs and all that. And I said, well, let's move in with me, man. Let's get your life cleaned up. Let's get you sober. We can do it. I'll get you off that crap. And he moved in and I got every colt backyard thing I could find. And there was like 40 head of horses standing there. And that's all we did. We drank Miller High Life and we punched cows and rode colts. He wanted to learn. So in my mind, I think, well, what better way to get off drugs? We're just going to get it on. Like, I'm going to work you to death. You're never going to leave other than if we go day work. And so we did. We got him sober. And got his family back together. He got a good ranch job, like all the things. And the whole time I'm feeling like, man, well, what, how are you to, you know, I didn't feel good about it. I felt good that he was doing good, but I was like, how can you tell somebody how to live his own life? Like, yeah, he come ask for your help, but how can you tell somebody that stuff? You've never lived in his shoes. You know what it's like. Like, I felt like a hypocrite.
Right.
So he shows up one day and he's got a bag of dope. He's like, man, I'm over it. I think we could do this just to have fun. And I was like, yeah, well, let's smoke it. See what happens. You know, and I was drowning in my own stuff at that time. Like the weed wasn't working anymore. The cocaine, I didn't do it enough, but I like to get high and not feel. Like I like to get numb. Nothing. And man, the first time he taught me how to light the pipe and do all the things. You got to have a PhD to smoke meth. It's hard. You burn it. It tastes horrible. I mean, it's super intense. He taught me how to do it, and we smoked some of that meth, and the feeling that washed over me was awesome. I was addicted after that first bowl of meth. And so we smoke it, and he leaves and goes back to his ranch job. And I don't do it for a while. And then he comes back, and we do it again. And then I kind of get to fiending. I'm like, man, I could do this recreationally, like smoking weed and drinking and doing a little coke here and there. Like I could recreationally smoke meth. So I lived by the Anton Chico land grant. There's lots of great, beautiful people there. And then there's some sorry ones. Well, if you go to the bar enough, you can differentiate the two. So I go to meeting some people, and in the drug world, like when you're at the bottom of the barrel, you start off buying stepped on drugs and things that aren't good. And you slowly go to meeting more people, and you're kind of networking in a way in the drug world. And finally I worked my way up to the big guy around there, the big lady. And I could get big bags of dope that wasn't stepped on, that was like pure crystal meth. And
how are you affording this?
So selling stuff, stealing stuff, money out of my wife's purse, go to the ATM, drive to the gas station in Las Vegas, take out $60. You know, we're buying beer. We're doing something.
You could explain it away easy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In the beginning, yeah, like it was simple. It was for this or that. Or, you know, you go to Tractor Supply and they let you take out a 20 or whatever. And then you go to the big R and you do the same thing. And it looks like you're just buying stuff. And so that's kind of how the money came. And then, you know, you get to run around those people, like you go buy drugs and they'll smoke you out. You go to the dope house and give them your $100 and get your quarter bag or whatever you get. And they'll smoke you out and you think you become friends with them, which really what they're doing by smoking you out, looking back on it now, they're just feeding you more of it. Like, all right, we'll smoke this guy out and he'll be back. And you always went back. And, you know, and so then me and Chris are smoking meth together a lot more. And like I'm making secret runs to meeting places because I've found the place where we can get a lot of dope. I found the guy. And so we're like making, like, I'm going to go feed cows. And boom, fly the feed pickup, meet Chris somewhere, give him his dope, get more money from him, and we're doing all the things. And my wife finds my first pipe, the first pipe she finds. And, you know, then we get the, what the fuck is this? And all the questions and I browbeat her. You know, I'm like, oh, it's just this. And it was Chris's, and put it off on my friends and whatever, and he's smoking dope again and all that. I'm not doing that shit. I'm the one that got him off of it. How dare you think that I do that? And so as time goes on, she finds baggies and she finds more pipes and it just created this horrible thing between us. And I didn't care because whatever, you found my pipe, that's $2 down the drain. Whatever dope was in the pipe, I'll go to town, get me another pipe. I'll run back to the drug dealer, get more drugs. That stuff consumed my life. All's I wanted to do, like my horses got neglected, the ranch got neglected, the cows got neglected, my wife got neglected. I shut my family out. I felt like that if I pushed everyone away, I wouldn't hurt them. But in all reality, I did way more damage by doing that than I, you know, I mean, yeah, we did the damage doing the drugs and all that, but I shut everyone out and self-secluded and just got high with my buddy or by myself. A lot of the time by myself, I'd sit in my shop and try to build bits and spurs and just get baked. And so towards the end of my addiction, the ultimatum came. My wife was pregnant, and it was, she, I, I'd come in the house because I was coming down. I didn't have a lot of dope, and I knew it, and I didn't have a lot of money. And so I went to sleep in the recliner, and I left my pipe in that pickup. And she found it, and she come in and throwed it at me. And we had a big old screaming match. And well, she did. I didn't really care. I just, you know, I was coming down. I didn't feel good. And then I victimized her again. Like, how dare you, all this and that. And then I play the, well, I'll quit. And I, we cried and all the things. And gonna be a better man, all that mess. And walked out the door, had a backup pipe. And she found that one too in the shop. And then that's when the ultimatum comes. She says, look, she was pregnant at the time. She said, if you don't clean your shit up, I'm leaving and you will never get to meet your unborn child. I'm done. You fix your shit or I'm done. And I didn't care. And that night I went back out to the shop and it really started hitting me like, man, you are fixing to lose everything. This job, your wife, your unborn child, your family, like, what have you done? What have you done for the last 3 years? Almost four. And I hit my knees and I went to praying. And I asked God to get me out of that situation that I was in. And I stayed out there all night. And that next morning, my parents at 9:30 show up unannounced in my driveway. And if somebody tells me that God doesn't answer prayers, I'll tell them they're full of it. And they said, what's going on? What's your deal? And my wife spilled her guts. And I spilled mine and told them I was addicted to methamphetamines and the whole story. And mom said, well, I kind of figured I've got you the option for some rehab centers. Are you willing to go? And I said, yes. And 2.5-3 hours later, we are on the road to Sayre, Oklahoma, to Rob's Ranch, Path of Miracles. One of the greatest things that ever happened in my life. And I was mad about it at the time. I was mad that I couldn't do drugs no more. I was mad that they were helping me and that God answered my prayers. I was so pissed off. And they checked me into that place. And that first morning I woke up, I told myself, I said, if you're going to do this, you're going to do it. Anything and everything these people ask of you, you're going to do it. You have pissed your life away. And if you want all the things that you have, you're going to do everything they ask of you, be an obedient servant. And I did for 30 days. Whatever them people ask of me, I did. My counselor, Troy, is a wonderful man. I still talk to him today. And they give me the tools to get clean and sober. And that was a Christ-centered rehab center. And I never grew up going to church a lot. You know, it was Easter, Christmas, those things. My folks weren't churchgoers, none of that. And yes, the alcohol addiction side of it was great. I got all the tools I needed to stay clean and sober, and I'm 2.5 years clean and sober today.
Come on.
But the thing that I got the most out of it was learning how to live life on life's terms and my walk with the Lord. I'd never had that. I'd never had that. You know, I guess I always had love at home, but that somebody loved me unconditionally with no regard to my screw ups, fuck ups, all my mess. It didn't matter. And that security of that brotherhood of men, and then God that loved me unconditionally no matter what, that was something that just I loved and I craved. So I leave that place. And life hit me in the face. There's no more support group. There's no more big group, little group, AA meetings at night, church, none of that. And super weird between me and Stephanie. Like, you know, I know you went and got your help, but you're still that motherfucker. And she had no trust in me, no nothing. And she had every right not to. I don't think that lady still fully trusts me today. And that's fine. She has every right not to. Every right. And so go back to the ranch in New Mexico and like I said before, I lived 3 miles from a bar and I lived 8 miles from my drug dealer. That was not where I needed to live.
Yeah.
And while I'm gone in rehab, like me and Steph got to talk on the phone at night, the little bit that she would talk, and we sold dogs and we sold horses and she did. She sold a bunch of shit and we bought a fifth wheel and moved it to Amarillo, Texas. And the reason we moved it to Amarillo, Texas was I could have got a ranch job coming out of there in a lot of different places, but she said, I'm not going with you. I want to be somewhere around my family. And she had family in Amarillo, Texas.
Good for her.
So we moved that fifth wheel there and I called some ranches and things. I thought I was going to have to go to work in a cow detention center, a feed yard. Really didn't want to do that, but if that's what I had to do, great. And, finally got a hold of a good friend, a friend of mine, that runs the LS ranch in the Kinsabi. And so he said, you bet, come day work for us. So this is like, right before Christmas time. Day work a little bit. We leave, go do the Christmas thing, get to be around her family, little of my family. It was hard because I was freshly out of there. Everybody knew our mess at this point. And, you know, Stephanie's mom and Tommy and her grandparents, they just embraced me and told me they were proud for what I did and loved me. And my parents did the same thing too. And day work for that ranch turned into a full-time job, left there, went to Amistad, New Mexico to another ranch job. Was going through a bunch of stuff, you know, that bouncing around deal, that don't like it, leave, go somewhere else. I was tired all the time. You know, you starve your body of everything when you do meth. Like I didn't eat a lot. And I think when I walked into rehab, I weighed 190 some odd pounds. Wore a size 33 Levi. And I haven't worn that. Like high school was the last time I could fit into a pair of 33 jeans. And in rehab, they feed you well. Because we all know meth addicts starve themselves of everything. So I like weigh 255 by the time I get out of there. And I am a lazy piece of shit. I don't want to work. I just want to work on myself and kind of my journey. And so we bounce around to ranches because this one was too much work and this one wasn't enough. I'm not happy. I'm just not in a good place. moved to Perryton, Texas to a starter yard. That was a stupid thing to do. Loved the guy I worked for, but that is a very intense job. And hated every minute of it. But I drug myself to work because I told myself that I was going to do the next right thing. Like, you fuck up again, there's no more family. And if you lose your wife and your kid, you're going to lose your sobriety and you're going to die. And that was it. You know, I found out when I got out of rehab that the lady that I bought drugs from, she owed the big drug dealer in Albuquerque a lot of money. And he sold her a batch of fentanyl and it killed her and three other people. And this was like right after I went to rehab, within that week. So if God hadn't have intervened, I'd be dead. And found the job where I'm at now, T Cross Ranches, training horses. And we, two and a half years clean and sober, and trying to do it on my own, like move down there, no friends. My mom and dad live there and I work with my dad every day. Some days that's super hard, but we make it work. And trying to heal, trying to do the things, get in a better place with me and my wife and my child, and just trying to do the next right thing. And not feeling fulfilled, like me and my wife. So this is present day now, I guess you could say, like we're in a really good spot, but church hopping, can't find the things that feed us. We're doing good, but not, I'm not doing good in some ways. And I pray all the time for the things that I wanted to be fed. And this is when you come into the picture. Justin calls, we go do the alcohol addiction thing in Elko, and I listen to the podcast and I'm like, dude, I can relate with all these guys. This is something I want to be a part of. And I told my wife, I'm like, this, I don't care what it costs. I'm going to that retreat. I'm going to the Firestarter deal. This is what I've been craving. And I get up here, man, and it's just been a whirlwind of nothing but good things in my life. It's changed my way of thinking. Just the tools and the things that you guys are doing are amazing. And I thank you for it.
Man, thank you. Thank you for your vulnerability and for you sharing your story and the seeds that you're going to plant in the people that hear this, brother. Like, this is it. You're home. You found your crew. You found your boys. You found your tribe. And you're not alone. You're not alone. Your story, I relate to your story more than anybody I've ever had on here. Like, I'm just sitting here the whole time shaking my head, like, and what's cool about that is I feel more hope now than I did when we sat down. Cause there's areas of my life and my shame and my brokenness and the things that I did to my wife, just hearing you be vulnerable, that I don't feel alone in anymore. That's the beautiful gift of this, right? Is iron does sharpen iron. I literally have a new compassion and opportunity and invitation to go, when you guys leave, into my house and validate some things in my wife that I didn't know until you told me your story. Because I did the same things. That's the beauty of this thing, brother. Like, it's amazing. And I'm so grateful that Justin hooked us up and we got to meet, and I got to meet your beautiful, amazing wife and spend break some bread with her and you guys when we were in Elko. And like I told you last night, this is it. We're lifers.
This, yeah, for me it is. Like I've searched 2.5 years for this. I had it when I was in rehab. And then it quit. You know, when you're down there in the bottom of the barrel and it's cold and dark and you get out of there and all those people that you think would be there, none of them were there. I had 4 dudes call me and ask me how I was when I got out of there. And those are the 4 dudes I still talk to today.
And yeah, it is amazing. The compassion, the thing we talk about all the time, right? On the other side of vulnerability, what we're afraid of and why we aren't vulnerable in sharing our stories, our struggles, and all the hard things is we won't be accepted. And I think this weekend was proof of that because you got to meet some of these freaking giants like Jay Heck and Gary Black and Brian Bird and Doc. Like, don't have the same story as us, but there's your new brother.
Yeah.
That lives a little bit to the west of you in Texas, right? Like that's the power of what this is, the connection, the phone numbers that are changing is like, and the message of hope in this,
you know,
this message is you're not alone. And the power of vulnerability is it's always met with acceptance and grace,
you know,
and compassion.
It's like cowboy and you get to grow up around your heroes and you get to grow up around those guys that have gone before you and you look up to and you strive and want to be like. And for me, that whole thing has shifted after this weekend. I have met a group of shining lights in a sorry old world. And all the men that were here this weekend are beautiful souls. And the thing that I want to say the most is we are all screwed up in our own way. And a lot of men go down a bad road for no damn reason. All we have to do is talk. The things that are hardest, this is my standpoint, the things that are hardest to say are the things that need to be said. And if more men could open up and learn to say those things, we would not have near the problems in this world that we have.
That's it.
I strive to be like the you men that have gone before me. Your walks with the Lord, the way you are with your families, your wives, your friends, people on the street. You're shining lights and beautiful souls.
Thank you, brother.
You are too, already.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, we had the pleasure of sitting around and hearing a lot of men share some very, very vulnerable, very, very dark stuff. And I agree with you. The definition of hero for me over the years changes. It's not the guys who have everything together, which, you know, it's what it looked like back when I was a kid. It was Indiana Jones. It was Han Solo. They might have been a little rough around the edges, you know, and some people that I actually knew. But now, having had the opportunity to sit across from people in a small town, drinking coffee, some of the most broken people with some of the most horrific stories I've ever heard are at this point some of the most grounded, some of the most truthful, the most authentic, the most trustworthy people. And to be with that type of person is very, very, very rare. And I found myself feeling more comfortable around a person who could confess to you, I'm the most unput together man, but I'm learning to live in this moment right now. And I'm discovering that in this moment, God is all that I need. And in this moment, the best that I can do is be faithful to those that God has put in my kingdom and entrusted to my care.
You know, and I guess I've put on a facade all my life, and I know lots of people that do. And when I went to rehab, I got that taste of real and raw. Mm. And it felt oh so good. Saying the hard things, doing the hard things, like, yeah, we can all put our happy face on and just, oh, he's got all the things and the good horses and this is and that's and his life's got to be great. And it's probably a dumpster fire. Mm-hmm. But those people that have the things and that will tell you that their life's a dumpster fire, man, I gravitate to that now. Because I'm fucked up too. And I'm like, you're not alone. I'm not alone. Like we're jacked up individuals. Let's get this on together. Like you want to fix it. Let's do it. Cause that's what I want. And I know guys out there that don't, they want to wallow in it. They're happy drinking and not doing the things that they're supposed to do. And I mean, you just said a mouthful, Jay, like that's, I guess, I don't know if it's seasons in your life or what it is, but it's a shift. And for me, this weekend has been one of those shifts. And, you know, I guess all my life I've kind of gravitated to the loners and the misfits. And my mom always said when I was a kid that the kids that nobody wanted to play with, that's who I'd go play with. And, you know, what you guys do at Wild Courage, a lot of people aren't accepting of because they're like, hey, you don't talk about feelings. You don't do that mess. And you're the kids that nobody wants to play with. I want to play with you because the games that y'all play are awesome.
So I think lots of times our story, and especially when God enters into the story, we can begin becoming aware of what we've really wanted all along. So, you know, sitting here listening to your difficult but hard, and yet now becoming, it's evident, it's a good story. It's a really good story. Back your sophomore, junior, senior year, stealing your grandparents' car, drinking, you know, began, what, a decade, 15, 20 years of just continuing the same thing over and over and over again, but to a greater and greater degree. You know, to sit here and witness, you weren't just looking to get a little buzz. You were looking to go totally numb. Like you are all in every time. If you were to say, I'll just ask you the question. If I had met you and was a friend, you know, and we'd been drinking beer in a barn somewhere, and I were to ask you, what do you want? What would you have said?
Another beer. Hmm.
To what end? At that point,
till they were all gone.
So today, I mean, that how many years were you looking for another beer?
Up until 2.5 years ago. I mean, the beer drinking slowed down, but the meth consumption shot through the roof. Like that consumed my life. I didn't want to drink. I'd drink a little water because I knew I had to stay hydrated. And I would go eat because I knew I had to keep my body going. Because when you stay up for days on end, I mean, this was the routine at the end of my addiction. I would scurry around, smoke dope all day and do the things and try to hide it from my wife and all that. Go in at night and eat supper. Hey, babe, I want to go to the barn for a couple hours and, you know, work on a bit or work on a pair of spurs or some buckles. And the next conversation I had was with my wife was, "Hey, babe, what's for breakfast?" As I walked through the front door, not being to bed all night. Mm.
So I love Jesus' wisdom as a man. And he came, you know, we were having breakfast and coffee this morning, and we never really finished talking about one of the interactions that Jesus had with a guy who'd been blind, you know, his whole life. And the blind guy hears Jesus is coming down the road, doesn't know much about him, but just, he says, this guy might have what I've been looking for my whole life. Looking back over, just the, considering that this man's been overlooked, probably cheated, betrayed, belittled, you know, his whole life. Who knows what goes through the mind and the heart of somebody who's been born blind. And he begins calling out. People tell him to shut up. Shut up. Don't bother him. We were talking a little bit about that this morning as well.
Yeah.
That we can be very tempted to think that we're just not worth God's time or his attention or his counsel or being loved. But this man, I think, is an example to us, just continued to call out louder and louder and louder until Jesus called him over. And then Jesus says the most incredible question, which, I mean, I sit with all the time. What do you want me to do for you? So you just wanted another beer most of your life, but, you know, being with you and us being together with this group of men, how would you answer that question now? What do you really want?
To be happy, joyous, and free in whatever God wants of me. I sat in my motel room this morning and I prayed and asked of things. And you know, I couldn't hear him. And I went outside. We had this conversation earlier and things went to flooding in my mind. The thoughts and all the things that I asked of him this morning. And I walked back in there and that Bible verse was in handwritten by someone in the back of that Bible. And man, after that, I'm no more driver's seat for me.
So to be clear about this, you went back in your room. You've been praying for God to speak to you.
I asked for him to show, I asked for him to reveal himself to me. I said, "God, I'm done." I said, I'm broken and I'm empty. I see the things that you're trying to do around me. You've led me to these guys and this group of people and all these things. And I said, I'm so hungry. Just show me that this is where you want me to be and this is what I need to do. Give me a sign that I'm on the right path. I've searched for 2.5 years for this. Is this it? And then I look over and see that Bible underneath the nightstand. And I pick it up and I just hold it where I can see the pages. And I drop it on the table and it opens up to that back page and somebody, it was 1 Corinthians 1-9, I believe.
1 Corinthians 13. The love chapter.
And that's what it opened to. And I read that and I cried the happiest tears I've ever cried in my life. He showed me he's real for the second time in my life. He did it whenever I asked to get out of my addiction. And he did it right there in that moment and said, this is where you need to be. You are doing what you need to do. And before that, I was kind of angry at the end of my 2.5 years because I'm like, man, this is not
this is not going. This is not happening. I'm in a rut. I'm on an island. And it's all in God's time. I've never been a super patient person. And, you know, I thought that I needed a core group of guys and all the things, and that's what was going to heal me and make me better. And I need all the things. I've always been that person. Need all the things. And for 2.5 years, the things I needed were right in front of me. My wife and child. That was my core group. I know that now. That was my core group. There was healing and rebuilding to do there. And now I get to do a little, which in turn does a lot for my wife and son and my family. And that's the mind shift that happened for me this morning.
Beautiful. I think that's about as good a spot as we're going to find to land this plane. There's nothing more to say. Bro, respect and honor that I have and feel for you is off the charts. Proud of you. You're amazing. You're an amazing husband and dad, and you're in the becoming, right?
Yeah.
None of us arrived. It's like that. We've talked about there's like finished bridal horse. What is that? They're never done. Just like this journey. You never finish. You just keep going and have a band of brothers to lock arms with that you know that have gone before you, like you've said, and you can lean into that when you're getting sticky spots and hard spots, and they can give you an arm up. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. What you're doing and giving your life to, which is your family. It's amazing. I'm really proud of you, and it's an honor to get to know you, and thank you for sharing this space with us and bringing your true self and the vulnerability of the past, the hope for the future, and the honesty of today, which is what you shared with Jay and I sitting in this space. So thank you.
Well, thank you guys. And I want to thank God for laying this on your heart, Jeremy, and Doc and Brian and starting this whole deal and bringing all this together and doing the next right thing. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. If we do the next right thing every day, what more can you ask for? Be the person that God made us to be.
That's it.
I love you guys, and thank you.
What's your wife's company again?
The Thrifty Cowhand. If you ever see my face, I'm the face of the business.
Oh boy.
Yeah, she got a picture from the back, and you kind of see my flowing mustache.
But that's nice. Deal. Yeah. That's why it's still going, I'm sure. Love you guys. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Thank y'all.
Great to be here.